This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another exciting episode of Stand Up Comedy, host and MC. And I am thrilled today because I have two, count them two, celebrity radio DJs joining us today. And these guys were both instrumental in helping Laughs Unlimited get off the ground back in the 80s. There's this relationship between comedy and radio. It doesn't exist anymore, sadly, since radio went corporate. But back in the 80s and early 90s, there was just so much going on. So let me introduce them. First off, coming to us over the phone back in Wisconsin, right?
No, Minnesota.
See, I knew I'd get it wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear from my good friend and professional DJ from the Bob and Tom radio show, Tim Bador.
God bless you. Evolution honors you, whatever your belief system. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Tim. And right here in the studio, an old friend, and we were just kind of doing a little catching up before I turned on the record button, but we go way back to the 80s. He was in radio, I was in comedy, and the rest has been history. But please help me welcome not only a gentleman that's been in radio since the late 70s, and a number of stations, which we'll touch on once we get into the conversation. But you also have a long history in Elk Grove and Sacramento, starting with your grandfather doing agriculture in Elk Grove. And that moved you here, right?
Yeah, born and raised in Elk Grove.
That's incredible. And I was able to do a little research and learn quite a bit. You went to Elk Grove High School, which is where my kids went in wow. Small world. My niece and nephew go there now. You also went to Sac City and Sac State. So you got a good college education right here in Northern California. And just lots and lots of history. So thanks for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Tom Nakashima. Wow, it's so exciting to have you in the studio. And I'm sorry, I kind of went off memory lane, but I didn't know you had such a great history in Elk Grove.
Yeah, born and raised there. So, you know, most guys in radio start somewhere else. And so I'm probably the luckiest guy. I've had the luckiest career.
You've stayed in this area. Yes. So, Tim, I know you got your start in radio in Sacramento, didn't you?
Oh, no. I was in college in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and then did a one summer at a commercial station in Stevens Point, enough to know that I didn't like Top 40 or was not good at it. That false enthusiasm for everything by the Bee Gees and Grease and whatever it was that summer. And then I left, went to Ventura, California, and then to Sacramento.
I had no idea that you bounced around doing that before you came to Sacramento, because I met you. You were a DJ at KZAP, right?
Correct, yes. But, you know, that wouldn't have been the kind of market, unless, you know, like Tom, that you grew up there, you wouldn't have started probably there in radio. You know, you know somebody in your hometown or got an internship or whatever. So, yeah, that's how it worked out, and bounced around a little bit after that, too, because radio is a bounce-around kind of career unless you're very lucky.
Tom, and Tom, I know you kind of got exposed for the first time to a microphone as an announcer at the Sacramento Raceway,
That's right.
Man, that's announcing right. And doing commercials for the Sacramento Raceway back in the 70s. How did that lead to radio?
My longtime friend and owner of the track, Dave Smith, didn't want to spend any money to have somebody cut a spot for it, right? So I was...
isn't that how it always starts?
So he had me cut a... I had never cut a spot in my life. So we got a drag race coming up, and he said, can you cut a spot for the you know, this Sunday, you know, one of
were
those.
You one of those Sunday, the Sacramento Raceway? I remember those as a kid.
I went down to the radio station, which was KXOA, which was the station I would eventually, you know, be hired. I went down there to cut a spot. And I know that the guys down there goes, who is this guy? Right? Who is this kid? And, but I was, that was my first time going into a radio station. And wow. I'm sure they thought, oh my God, we got to, you know, bringing a client in here. So, but yeah, my first job on the mic was track announcer out at Sacramento Raceway.
And so, and the first radio exposure was cutting commercials.
I cut one spot for the track, and I got a, you know, my first part-time job was at KXOA. That's where I stayed.
Wow, that's incredible. Tim, were you doing spots originally? How did you become, because it takes some talent to from the engineering side to be a DJ. Did you, were you interning or did you do it in, you said
no,
college?
No, the great thing, and I went to the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, specifically because it had and has, to this day, although waning interest in radio on the younger demographics, but had a very high-flying, low-wattage, 300 watts of rock and mono, we called ourselves.
300 watts of rock and... that's funny.
But, yeah, at one point, we had half the student body regularly listening and had, you know, actual ratings in the town, and you just learn by doing. You get in there, and it's, you know, 4 years of college and hanging out at the radio station every moment that you weren't in a class, or sometimes when you were supposed to be in class, and learned by doing. And by the time that I got out of college, I was able to get work.
Oh, that's cool that the college gave you that opportunity. You went to Sac State. Were you doing communications or was it just degree stuff?
In my day, Scotty, if you told somebody you wanted to be in radio, they would just laugh. They thought, that's not a career. What are you talking about? And so, and when I remember when I was at Sac City, I was afraid to tell anyone I didn't, you know, I like radio, because they would look at you, no, a real career. That's not a career, you idiot. And
it's kind of in the same way that a carnival, parents wouldn't say, yeah, join the carnival.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to go to the circus? That's not a career, you idiot. So, it, you know, really there wasn't, I don't recall a curriculum, you know, for people who want to be in broadcasting. And I remember a counselor says, I don't know what to tell you. Just take some speech classes or, you know. So that was kind of a secret. You know, my contemporaries, they're going to be engineers, pharmacists. You know, I wasn't good at any of those things. I am still not. I don't know how to do anything.
So radio is the last bastion.
Yes. Yeah. You know, so you're in radio, you're always waiting for the other shoe to drop. Wait till they find out I shouldn't be doing this. And so that was, you know, when I'm, what, 21 years old, I didn't want to tell anyone. You know what I'd really like to do is be in radio. I have no role models. I didn't know anybody who was, you know, who was
actively doing it, right?
And,
right.
And so when I, you know, in those days, there's no voice tracking. You went on in the middle of the night, and I discovered – this is way harder than I thought. And I wasn't the worst disc jockey in California. I was the worst disc jockey in America.
Oh, Tom, yes. You keep putting yourself down.
When I put the headphones on, I go, oh, this is a big mistake. This is harder than I thought.
Well, you've been doing it over 40 years. Go ahead, Tim.
It's absolutely true that, and most everybody will tell you this, especially when you're starting out that on radio, that the minute, the second that you turn the microphone on, half of what you knew leaves your brain. And so you prepared, thought about what you were going to say, and then literally for years, half of what you had already prepared or thought about would just go. For whatever reason, it is not easy.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I had in an interview with Paul Robbins and Phil Cowan, who are real also crucial to the start of Laughs Unlimited and did a lot of comedy. They were actual comics that ended up in radio and then eventually TV. But they were saying how fickle the business was and how they would be top of the world one day and out the door the next. And they did actually travel and did something, I think, also in Texas or Arizona, somewhere else. But Tim, you were finding that this job, you mentioned having to move around before and after you were in Sacramento. How would you describe the business from a, Tom, I think, is got to be the only guy I know in show business at all that's been able to work in one town and one company for 40 years.
Yeah, no, it's hugely rare that happens, even if that's what you want. I know a handful of people that have, guys from Wisconsin that I, was in college radio with, and they've made wonderful careers in the, central Wisconsin because that's what they wanted. It is just so hard because radio management, radio ended up being the bastard stepchild of broadcasting. all the quality people went to TV, and radio was left with, people who, should have been at the carnival but didn't want to travel.
Well, we've all worked with Bob Keller, and he's one of those guys that's had a long career in one town. He's kind of famous. Yeah. Him and Tom are both long-time famous DJs in the Northern California, Sacramento area. But it's interesting that there's even any. I thought Tom might be the only other than Mr. Keller, but it's the fact that you know of a few others. So it's rare, but it has happened. Tom, what would you say it led you to staying and the capability to stay with one area?
I'm a homebody. I am just a homebody. I can imagine, the first thing everybody tells you is that, you have to work out of your market. You have to get a job somewhere else. Most of my friends in radio did that. They grew up maybe in the Midwest, or they grew up in the East. They had to start somewhere else. Once I started here, I thought, God, I can't imagine myself being somewhere else. My family's here. My friends were here.
Well, you have a long heritage, as I alluded to earlier.
So, I got lucky.
So for you, the list of stations you worked at are, go ahead, share.
When I started, it was called K108, KXOA. And then I moved to the Eagle in, I guess it was 98, same company. The Intercom bought our company, and I went down the hallway, and I've been 96.9.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know in radio, it's similar to TV. You will have several stations or several channels really sharing a building, mm-hmm. and you could go down the hall and you're in a whole different station. So that's fascinating. So Tim, as a comparison, can you name some of the stations you work for?
WWSP 90 FM 300 watts of rock and mono. and then WSBT, which was, in fact, the summer that I was there, it was a really good, station to learn radio, very demanding. And they won Billboard Small Market Station of the Year that year. And a lot of people went through there actually and became and went to major markets. So it was a good station. Then Ventura, KZAP, Sacramento, then KLOL in Houston for a year. And then I ended up after that in San Francisco at a station called The Quake.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And that station was really one of the reasons that I ended up full-time in stand-up is that, one, radio is what it is, and people that own comedy clubs far, far more integrity than radio station management. But, the morning show, a guy named Alex Bennett did the morning show at the Quake. I did the afternoon show, and his morning show was all comedians. So all the local comics would go on with Alex, and we would promote comedy shows. And that's one of the reasons they were interested in me, was I was starting to do stand-up, and they just wanted to have that comedy connection, and did. And I just started, you know, San Francisco in the 80s. Stand-up boy was just so dynamic and so much fun. And so it was just a perfect match, and I transitioned out of radio full-time.
And went into, we should say, went into comedy very successfully. You're a top headliner. You've worked clubs coast to coast and around the world, and a very, very funny guy. So that's a great transition for where I wanted to take this conversation with you and Tom. And Alex Bennett would be a great center starting place for somehow there was this great connection that I'm hoping you guys can explain between comedy and radio, especially back in the 80s when before radio got so corporate and we could actually, I mean, I used to drop in on KZAP weekly and sometimes we'd be on for a couple hours. It was crazy. And you could never get away with 2 minutes, let alone 2 hours in today's market. So, Tom, how do you, you know, you did a lot with the club. We had lots of, Lizanne Hunt was representing the station. We did a lot of special events, birthday parties, fundraisers. The Beaver came out and kicked off some shows. That was the mascot for the station. How would you explain the relationship with stand-up comedy and radio?
Well, first of all, you know, for Tim to master two completely different disciplines, radio and stand-up comedy, they are similar, but the kind of discipline you have, the fact that he was successful in both is really remarkable, because I'm sure he knows people that, you know, if you're in radio, somebody will say, well, you ought to do stand-up. It's not the same. Or you see somebody who does stand-up. Hey, you'd be great on radio. You can't even say that with television. You'd be great. Yeah, that's why Paul Robbins is remarkable. He's been successful in radio and in television and in stand-up. Nobody does that.
No, that's, you know, interesting.
He's unique. They are two different things.
Completely different things.
How... you'll see, and it takes some time, but they often thought, well, let's get a comedian to do the morning show, and more often than not, it would not work, and it would not work dramatically, just yeah. Because,
well, you know, the
thing of being on the radio, especially if you're going to have guests, I mean, and it was, I think, anybody that was successful in broadcasting of a certain age either was a huge fan of Johnny Carson or a huge fan of David Letterman. And if you watched those two people and absorbed the lesson of what broadcasting is, then you pretty much knew everything you needed to know about how to do it. Or if you listened to, in my case, WLS out of Chicago. It was as good as radio in America, in my mind, ever got. So if you were obsessive about listening and absorbing why they did this and why they do that, you could do it. You could, if you were talented.
You could study it.
I think most comics are thinking about themselves. They're not thinking about...
That's true.
You know, so it's not, I'm going to be a good host. I'm the center of attention. So that can work for you, but that'll burn you out if you're on 4 hours a day, you know?
No, definitely. And I would have thought that the biggest difference is that in radio, the audience is in your head because you're just talking to a microphone and there's no immediate response. And in stand-up comedy, you have all these people sitting right in front of you with expectations and you get to interact and you hear a response from them. But we've sidetracked a little because I wanted to point out that Tom had given Tim a very big compliment. So ladies and gentlemen, Tom complimenting Tim, let's hear it. But
that crowd got smaller. What happened to the crowd?
Well, they heard my voice. No, Tom, going back to your experience, though, in radio and back in those early days at K108, we were able to do a lot of comedy, not as much on air. We did more outside the station kind of events, Mardi Gras days and different things. But you were a big part of it. How did comedy fit into what you were doing on radio?
You were at the forefront. You and a few other people in the, what it would have been the early 80s. There was no YouTube. There was no, internet. This is live comedy. I didn't know what the hell that was. And you have this idea in your head. You're going to have a place for, live comics. So I remember you hadn't even built your club. You were using the banquet room of a restaurant in Old Sacramento, right?
Oh, yeah.
Was it the Delta Queen? Okay. So it's down the hallway. And I thought, well, this will be fun. We go to see the first show I ever saw. Now, Gary Shandling was well known among comics, but he was not the mainstream star yet.
Right. No, he came out as an opening act in 1980.
So we're going to see Gary Shandling. I don't know who this is. I've heard of him. I don't know who this is. There's two couples here and one more. Maybe six people in the audience, right? Maybe.
I was killing it.
Right. So this is midweek, and you had there was really no backstage. You had a curtain.
That was just a curtain.
And Gary is behind there. I realize he's behind there because you're going to bring him out. You're going to bring him out, and you introduce Gary, and he doesn't come out. This was, and I don't know if you remember this. This was the week of Pearl Harbor. It was either Pearl Harbor Day or right around there. So you introduce Gary, ladies and gentlemen, and there's only like six of us in the audience. Ladies and gentlemen, let's bring him out here. Gary, and he doesn't come out. Gary Shandling. And you know what he says from behind the curtain? I'm not going out there till the Japanese guy gets back. And I thought, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. I thought, and he's doing this to an audience of about six people. He then came out, did his whole show, and I'm trying to laugh for 300 people, but I can't. It can't be done. So I admired the fact that he had a, how Gary would have binder paper.
Mm-hmm. Show notes, right. He was always working on
stuff. He says, do you mind if I work on these?
Yeah.
And it was incredible. That's the first show I ever saw. I thought, oh, my God.
Wow.
Scott is on to something. And his opener, by the way, was Paula Poundstone.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he was kind of her mentor. Isn't that right?
He ended up doing a lot of work with her. Tim, yeah.
They were good friends.
Yeah.
When did you come into laughs, and do you remember who you saw?
It could have been... So it would have been 81. You were still at the Delta Queen.
Rocking it with six customers.
Yes.
Now in my memory, by then it was doing good business. Comedy was just so hot. And I think I definitely became friends with Bruce Baum was there. He had his song Marty Feldman Eyes. That we played briefly, and that actually, I'm sure we've told this story before, Scott, but Trying to support you and Bruce is what got me fired from KSAT, but that's another story.
Yeah, but Tom's getting a kick out of it. He hasn't heard it, so that's funny.
Yes, and Jimmy Alec, who is a great guy, great comic, dear friend, and Bob Saget, who I met first in Sacramento, and we remained friends all through the years. Shanling, certainly. I remember seeing Gary. And I think probably Seinfeld. I remember all those guys coming through and having them either on the air or, you know, you would let me host, not do 15 minutes of comedy because I didn't have it, but
you would MC some of the shows, and it was my way of getting that radio connection because, like I said, with you and Bob Keller on KZAP, I would literally show up once or twice a week with comics that ended up being famous entertainers, but at the time they were unknown, and we used to have so much fun. Bruce Babyman Baum was always a kick on the radio. Now, Tom, when you at K108, we did some radio stuff. Do you remember having a guest on the air with you, or was it do you mostly off-air stuff?
I remember doing an interview. We were still in Old Sacramento when Yakov Smirnoff came.
Oh, yeah.
And that had to have been, pretty early on, but he was pretty popular. And I remember the show that he did at the community center, because you had grown that show to a community center show. On the bill was Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah, Yakov and, was the opening act, right?
Jerry and Dana Carvey were the openers. Yakov was the headliner.
Oh, okay.
You remember that?
Well, yes, I had it in memory.
He was the headliner. And so they were all buddies. You know how popular Comedians in Cars is.
Right.
That basically is an offshoot of what these guys were doing backstage, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what they were doing. So I remember it was Dana Carvey. Jerry only did 30 minutes because he's the middle act. He was doing a favor for Yakov Smirnoff. That week, I had a lot of other stuff going on. I was also the ringside announcer for the amateur boxing Soviet Union match.
Wow.
It was at the Memorial Auditorium. They had only come once. And this was back during the Cold War.
Right, right.
Where you talk about a bunch of surly, you know. And so I'm trying to learn their names. And when Yakov Smirnoff came in for the interview, I told him this. He's obviously fluent. And he's helping me.
Oh, that's funny.
He's helping me with these names. So when it gets to the show night at the community center, before he goes on, you know what he does? He comes over and he says, "How are you doing on those names?" And he tested me.
Oh, really?
That's why even now I look at names like Trishev and Igorov. I got it from him.
Oh, that's so cool. I didn't know that story.
No, he was so gracious. And he, you know, he was a big hit that night. But the thing to remember is Jerry was in the middle, and Dana Carvey was the opener. Actually, you had those two other guys.
There's a picture actually.
Yeah.
The comedy boys
something like that.
But what's interesting is that it wasn't until you mentioned it that I remembered. I have photos of you because I think we had. K108 was a sponsor of one of my concerts, and you kind of opened the show and introduced
you let me open the show, and those days will never be replicated.
No, sadly. You know, but we had so much fun, didn't we?
Yes.
Now, Tim, you ended up doing a lot of my special events. Didn't you do Laughs in the Park or the TV show?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Both. Yeah. No, it was a rich intersection back when radio was typically live. They didn't fear having live people on. I don't know exactly when the fear of having a comic on became greater than the desire to have somebody on.
It seems like it's been decades, right, guys?
Yeah, no, it yeah. definitely, you know, because I, when I was on the Bob and Tom Show, I did a big syndicated show called the Bob and Tom Show, and I had a regular feature on Wednesday mornings. And so in all of these markets, they were hearing me regularly because I was live on Bob and Tom every week. And that didn't necessarily mean that when I went to Cedar Rapids or Madison, Wisconsin, or Fresno, California, even if the radio station was, the local radio station, was promoting the show, they didn't necessarily know how to have you on live.
Oh, so even though you were doing material on the Bob and Tom Show, the syndicated channels wouldn't let you go on?
It's not even a matter of would they let you go on. They might do a phoner, but that would be off the air. It would be off the air and edited.
Tom, is that your experience?
Well, somebody was playing records. And it's just because they just got out of the habit of being live, or because you could put it onto a computer, the phone, and edit it up later. Why not let it be safe?
Oh, yeah. God forbid we want anybody live. We wouldn't want that. So, you know, we do a phoner maybe to make some agent happy. I'm never using this because you're an idiot, right?
Oh, that's so funny.
Say, yeah, we're going to do a phoner with this. Just tell them we'll do a phoner. It will never air. You know, that happens sometimes.
Oh, wow.
And then sometimes you get lucky and, hey, I have a great couple of minutes with a guy. We just put that on. But you can cut it up and you can make it tighter.
Right, you know, or just use sound bites.
That's the main reason, is you can tighten it up, and it makes a lot more sense. It's better for the audience. It's better for everybody.
And I think it's also, you know, comedy kind of moved on in the 70s and 80s. We were all mostly trying to get on Johnny Carson, get on TV. That was the whole goal.
Well, that was the Holy Grail at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, Gary Shandling.
That's how you geared,
right.
You geared yourself that way. And you thought in terms of what flies in broadcasting and what you need to do if you're going to be on a local radio show promoting it. You know, we had a responsibility, you know, not only to our own show and the club, but all of comedy, that you didn't want to blow it for anybody else by saying the wrong thing on a show. Bit by bit by bit, as that starts to go away, comics just weren't thinking about what I'm going to be on the air, what I'm going to be like on the air. And so they weren't as good at it, I think, because they weren't thinking about it.
Yeah, that's interesting that radio was a way to kind of practice live exposure to an audience like television, and using it as a precursor to maybe getting the Mike Douglas Show or the Merv Griffin Show back in the days, were doing a lot of stand-up. And that was even a precursor to Carson and Letterman. So it's kind of a training path. I never thought of it that way. But I think what's interesting for me as a club owner and as a producer, I cherished and really tried to nurture the relationships with the stations and people like Bob Keller and Tom and you, because quite selfishly, it was getting exposure for this club that was really a new form of entertainment at the time. And I was taking advantage of the medium, which, again, back, people have to remember, in the 80s and 90s, radio rocked. I mean, that's how everybody got their music. There weren't iPods and even cassettes early on.
Right?
Right?
No, the...
No.
The whole
people
notion...
People listen to the radio.
And so, you know, the best radio people are storytellers, and you've got to be able to share with people how cool it is. Hey, that we got it. We're in Old Sacramento, just a block from here is a great new comedy club. This is what it's like. And I remember, once you had built Laughs, one day I stopped in on the way to work. Now, our office is just a half a block, so I stopped in, and Gary Shandling was there. And you basically told Gary, you said, "This is Tom. He cuts a spot he cut the spot for your appearance. And I told him, yeah, I stole one of your bits from Johnny Carson. And, you know, and as you know, Gary's demeanor is exactly the same off air as it is on air, right? He looks, he goes, which one was it? I told him which joke it was. And in those days, there's no YouTube. I had to record his bit on Carson and put it on a cassette and bring it to the studio and steal it. Remember that joke he had about people have compasses on their cars?
Right,
he
right.
Says, where are they going? Ecuador? And he goes, okay, I won't do it. And he didn't. I thought it was a great,
Right? So he figured it was out on the airwaves.
Yes.
It was burned.
And he goes, oh, okay, I won't do it. And he didn't.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Now it's so hard now because a comic goes up, his whole 12 minutes is on YouTube the next day, right? In those days, you could do bits in San Francisco and then you can do bits in Sacramento. It's, you know, there's a different audience. But now, Jesus, somebody calls you on, well, I heard that joke yesterday.
Oh, geez.
You know.
That's so funny that you bring that up, Tom. I had not really realized, but because, of course, I saw the acts, you know, Shandling, Dana Carvey, Seinfeld. They did the same material every show.
Yes.
And what made them good actors is that that all comics that are good, Tim, you can relate to this, make it sound like you just thought of it or it's a recent thought. You might have been doing it for 5 years on stage. So, Tim, how does this, what Tom brought up, how does that relate to, as a comic, do you feel that, at what level is material burned?
You know, thankfully, people don't have good memories. Otherwise, everybody would be a winner on Jeopardy. So, you know, it's crucially important that they forget your material. And that typically, I mean, it's one of the reasons I think comedy clubs would bring you back in 12 months, typically, because it kind of took that long for material to be erased out of people's brains. But I'm telling you, this is one of the oddest things. When you would see this on Bob and Tom, because they repeat bits like songs. There are some bits that are Stairway to Heaven that are just overplayed for decades.
Right, right,
and it's
right.
Amazing, but people still want to hear it live.
No.
And I never would have thought that in comedy, because there's no surprise. They know all the words. So it is, I thought for years, you know, you would either not do a bit if it was on the air, or if it was in an ad for your show, then you wouldn't want to give them your best bit. You'd want to, you know, just have something there. A minor bit and then not do it that night or whatever. But I learned that from the Bob and Tom thing, that people, at least that audience would laugh at something they've already heard before. You never would have thought that.
Well, I'm going to interrupt and say that as a producer, I did it differently than maybe other clubs. I like bringing comics in every 3 to 6 months because I want them to build an audience. And the same in getting on the radio. I want them to get on the radio a lot because it built an audience. And I actually had people come in or call up and say, hey, Tim's going to be there. Is he going to do this bit? Because I've told my whole family about him and I want him to come in and hear the bit live. So sometimes it was beneficial, like you're saying, to stick with your material. But as an artist, I totally comprehend why you would not want to repeat a bit, where the punchline's already a known factor.
It's curious how that, I think, has changed, because it was always the case, and people like, you know, Bruce Baum and whomever would, you know, teach you that when you go on the radio, be careful not to do your best material because it may burn it. And Leno, for example, always preached, never do an HBO special because all the material will be lost to you.
Oh,
you
interesting.
You spent 10 years building this routine, and now you can't use it anywhere because they're going to replay it.
Right.
I don't know that it worked that way, or maybe it did work that way and then stopped because America started to have even shorter attention spans, or there's, you know, too much fluoride in the water and the brain is somehow affected. But yeah, that was definitely a thing that you worried about, was burning material. The thing that was key for me between radio and doing stand-up was, you know, I was trying to do a lot of, you know, funny things on the air, and I had all these little bits and features, and but they were very popular on KZAP, and we were talking.
Well, you're talking about it when a DJ creates, like Bob Keller's lunch program. Tom, I don't remember any specific programs you did, but Tim, you used to do, well, we all know Vague But True.
Vague But True. When I phased up, I did Mother's Little Helper, which was bad advice. I played a pediatrician who gave bad advice on how to raise kids. And it was based on Dr., I think it was Lendon Smith, who was on TV at the time. And I just went the opposite way, giving bad advice. And it was very popular. And I did it one night at the club, literally in a doctor's
smock thing. Oh, that's funny.
And it died the worst death possible.
So learned.
And I literally, my hands were shaking. I had the script in my hand, and I looked up at the audience at one point, and I said, "You do like this on the radio, don't you?" And they all kind of looked at each other and said, "Well, we thought so."
Comedy clubs are a great proving ground for sure.
Well, but, you know, there's a difference between, and I think, you know, some of the stuff that, let's say, humorous writes or Woody Allen wrote in essays may be more creative. Even I enjoy it on a comedy level more than his stand-up or movies. I think it's his best writing, perhaps, but he couldn't get out loud laughs with it. Right. So there is a difference between getting an out loud laugh and maybe, you know, something from the radio or
still entertaining people
or an essay. Right?
Yeah, it might be
better, but it's not out loud.
Right. You're still entertaining them, but it's not the same as in a comedy club. Now, I didn't really ask, but Tom, you've been in radio 40 plus years or so. Have you created bits or anything that you've ran with? You just did straight music intros
and
commercials and promos.
Yeah.
I know that we have some of the promos that you did. I'm with this podcast, as my listeners know, we're big fans of Tim Bedore and the Vague But True series, and we've used those. But I have shared some of the promos that you did. We still have them. We have an archive of the radio promos. My partner, Bob Stobener, said to say hi. Remembers you fondly and saved a lot of the stuff you did and Bob Keller did and Tim has worked on and others back in the day. But one of the things I wanted to pivot to was the promotions were so important to getting the club known and aware. We've alluded to a couple. Tim did Laughs in the Park and my TV series. You mentioned hosting and being with the concerts. Do you remember any of the promotions that stood out for you, or was the concert the biggie, I guess?
I remember you had like an amateur night.
The Great Northern California Comedy Competition,
and there were, four or five of us were judges.
And you judged that?
And I remember four or five comics up there. And one of them was a school teacher, Del Van Dyke. I thought, God, he is good. He is right. I think he had a long career as a teacher, but it hit me that it might not be word for word, but there's something about somebody who has that it factor.
Right.
When you see it go by, right. You know, I don't even care what that joke was. The way you told it, I thought, wow, I want to see more of that. That was the kind of person. He wasn't a professional. I think he did dates at your club.
Well, he did go pro.
He did.
He ended up being a road comic and now produces shows. He's moved up to Idaho or something.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
But I remembered, I spent, 10 minutes with this guy. I go, that guy
and you
is
still
really
remember
good.
It.
I do, Del Van Dyke.
That's amazing. And I think it's a great to mention to the audience that one of your experiences was for the Great Northern California Comedy Competition, being a judge, because that's exactly what we would do. We would try to bring in local celebrities like radio DJs to be the judges, and even people from the newspaper, which newspaper is this big thing that has writing on it. and back then, the Sacramento Union, which is no longer with us, would send in one of their writers and be a judge. Tim, were there promotions that you remember working on or with?
Well, I remember doing, hosting, in fact, KZAP. It was interesting. They liked my involvement with you initially. Then they wanted money. which is always
isn't it always so?
It's just not enough to, we brought in a comedian Tuesday and it was great for the audience and everybody loves it. Oh, no, that's not enough. They need to spend money. Otherwise, we're not going to have money. But before that, I got to host an open mic at the Delta Queen with you. And it was going okay. We had judges on the stage, which, looking back, I would think that that's not the best way to do the funniest person thing, to have the judges right there on the stage, maybe in the back so they're not seeing the eye rolling or the whatever. But there was a guy who got up and, we didn't give mental health tests before to the contestants. We probably should have.
Right.
Literally, this guy was probably out of his mind, didn't present that way until he got up there, and then couldn't get him off the stage. And it was getting weird. The audience, half the audience was, booing and or get out of here, dismissive, and the other half was afraid that he might go off. don't poke the bear.
Wow.
And so we're kind of stuck in this strange space of what to do. And I tried to get up and tried to talk him, your time's up and we've got to move on. And, we have other contestants and he's still got, it could have been the Unabomber. He had a manifesto he wanted to give.
Oh, yeah.
And finally, Scott, you got a fire extinguisher.
Did I chase him off the stage?
Wow.
Yeah. You blasted him off the stage, and that's the only thing that got him off. And by the way, he took second.
That's a great story. Sadly, I don't remember that. But the fire extinguisher, we eventually at the new room had an actual hook that we could hook people and pull them off. But the fire extinguisher, that's funny. Thanks for sharing that memory, Tim. That's hilarious. Well, let me wind things up by saying that I was blessed with a lot of success at Laughs Unlimited. I had so much fun working with the creative entertainers, but also the creative people that we interacted with on radio and TV. And as Jill, my wife, would say, we don't miss owning a chain of bars and nightclubs at all, but we miss the people. And we were so lucky to get a chance to work with people like you two and several others, not only on the fringe of entertainment, whether it's radio, newspaper, television, but all the entertainers that came through the club. And so for your part, Tom, and your part, Tim, thank you so much for the success of the club, but also the fun that we were able to share through those, that, you know, first decade, especially the 80s, was my pinnacle when it came to radio and TV and stuff, and just enjoyed it. Tim, I did want to ask before we end up, Bob and Tom's a syndicated show, so it's aired all over the country. You were live. Would you go into a studio with Bob and Tom to record those?
Oh, no. No. I do it from first. We were in Los Angeles and then here in Minneapolis. I had a special box that they bought for me called the technology was ISDN and it uses phone lines and gives you broadcast quality over the phone. So it digitizes and then sends them a digital stream and it's reconstituted on their end and they send them back and literally almost in real time.
Wow.
You could be broadcast quality from my house.
That's incredible.
It was incredible. It really was so cool.
I think that's neat. And you've had a great career on the Bob and Tom Show and a great career as a DJ in stations everywhere as you got fired. And but in stand-up comedy, you're still going strong, and you've had such a great career in that. Tom, amazingly, you've stayed pretty much you stayed in one town, one station. You've had a lifelong career, huge success. Congratulations. How would you wrap this up? How would you feel that comedy benefited you or had an effect on your career?
I look back at that period. It was like the golden era. And that's no exaggeration of live comedy in this town in Northern California. And you were a huge part of it. And for those of us who were eyewitness, it made us realize how hard stand-up comedy is. And so that respect that grew out of that has stayed with me my whole life. And even now, I can see how hard it is to be a stand-up comic because you're called on the carpet for every damn thing you say. You know,
it's true.
It was a joke, right?
Right.
These are jokes. These are comics. What is he or she supposed to do? And then there's a platform for somebody to complain about it. I mean, you know, because he said this or he said that, you know, another generation, difficult. That's a laugh. That was funny. I thought that was funny. You can't, you know, it's hard to do that. So I think in many ways it's more difficult. But looking back, we are talking about things that happened 40 years ago, and I remember them like it was this morning. The time, after one of those shows, you and Bob and me and Gary Shandling went across the street and got a beer at that one of those little bars across the street. Uh-huh. And I remember thinking, you know, I'll never have a chance to buy Gary Shandling a beer, but I'm going to do it. And you know what he ordered?
What?
Something really fascinating, a light beer. Right? He said, I'll have a light beer. And I bought Gary a beer, and I thought, you know, I'll never have the chance to do that. And I never did.
Oh, that's so funny.
I had so much respect for the men and women who came through your shop, and I realized the art form that it was, and I would have never gotten a chance to see it up close if it weren't for you.
Oh, well, thank you. And that's a great way to cap a conversation about how radio and comedy have worked together. Tim, what would you like to share?
I would echo that sentiment. I mean, I got to dive in head first because you pulled me in. And then when I moved to Houston, I was not afraid literally, I would not have done stand-up had I not been invited. I wouldn't have assumed. And you invited me. And then after that, then when I went to Houston, I kind of knew there was a path and it would work if I were to host shows and have comedians on. But I don't know that I would have thought of it on my own. So, yeah, it was instrumental. I mean, KZEP was hugely popular and comedy was just this rocket ship that was taking off, and you were putting heart and soul into your club and the comics, and you know, just, it was just fun. It was just fun, but it did open a door for me. There's no two ways about it.
Well, thanks so much. And I think you're both, ending this, short interview, and thank you so much for joining me with an important realization that the 80s were special for so many reasons. It was a great time for many people financially. It was the huge wave of stand-up comedy becoming a recognized and appreciated art form. But also back then, radio was live and you could do fun and crazy things. And sadly, even though there's still stand-up comedy, it's not the same. And there's still radio. It is totally not the same. And the fact that we've had a chance to share a little bit of our history with my listeners is so, so special. Thank you, Tim, for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And Tom, it's been way too long, but thank you so much for coming out to the studio and sharing your memories and your time. It's a real honor. Thank you, sir.
Great to see you, man. Thanks.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, that's been my two friends, Tim Bedor and Tom Nakashima. We want to thank them for joining us on the show today, our little comedy roundtable on stand-up comedy and radio and how the two really work together to build this new fun industry from nothing into something. And we all three had a small part in that, and it's just been so much fun. Hey, thanks for listening. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to interrupt the end of this show with a special treat. As Tom mentioned, he did a lot of promos for us, and there was one in particular with Gary Shandling. Well, guess what? I still have that, and as a surprise to Tom and for all my listeners, here it is, Tom Nakashima on K108.
Hey, for a good time, come on over to Laughs Unlimited. A fellow who just appeared on The Tonight Show is headlining Thursday through Sunday, Gary Shandling.
And who are these guys with compasses on the dashboards of their car? Have you seen, where the hell are they going? Ecuador or what?
Also this week, Paula Poundstone from San Francisco. Doors open at 7 Tuesday through Sunday. Showtime is 8 Tuesday through Thursday, 8 and 10:30 Friday and Saturday nights. Call for reservations now. Laughs will rest Christmas week, but then, look out, you're invited for a fabulous New Year's Eve. Two shows, one at 7 p.m. for the Midnight in New York party, or come for the 10 p.m. show and share the fun when it's midnight here. The man who has no friends, Bob Saget, brings in the new year. Also, Jeremy Kramer from San Francisco and Chris McDermott from L.A.'s Comedy Store. New Year's Eve tickets must be picked up by December 19th, so call now for Laughs Unlimited reservations, 446-5905. And don't miss Gary Shandling this week.
He's so weird.
Wow, that was fun to hear again. It's been so long. That was done in about 1983, and Tom was real supportive of the club then, and it was great to have him come in and support the podcast now. And then my good buddy Tim Bedor, I thought that was a fun interview. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.